Blog Talk Radio.
There we go. Blog Talk Ladies Late. Happy Tuesday, everyone. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host, and tonight is the Ask Dr. Goodman Show. We're going to talk about informal caregivers for HD. What is that? I didn't know there was such a thing as informal caregivers, but I guess that's what I am. So get your questions ready and call into one of these numbers, 310-982-4227 or 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1. We'll cue you into the show. And thank you, 93,000 listeners, for tuning in to Help for HD Radio. Dr. Goodman, and thank you for bringing this incredible and wonderful education information to us as resources to our HD community. So read Dr. Goodman's article, Informal Caregivers. I'll put up the link here in a minute. Welcome to the show, Dr. Goodman. How are you?
I am good. Thank you.
And thank you for such a quick and speedy article for us today.
Well, as I was researching this, the word informal is uncomfortable. For me, because
yeah.
what does informal mean? Does it mean unimportant?
No.
It is not unimportant, but it is the word that is, you know, the word. I don't know who invented these words to describe people who give care to people with chronic illness, whether it's informal. Usually it refers to someone who is giving this care unpaid, which is what almost all family members do.
Right.
So
right.
Important family caregivers are termed informal.
Right.
I don't like the word, but it is what it is. I think the implication is somewhat, it's a little, I can't think of the right word. It flew out of my brain. Patronizing, in a way, I think.
Right.
You know, it's just, but I don't know. I don't like the word.
It doesn't give us any glory, does it? Informal.
Well, it seems, yeah, it just doesn't give the credit where credit is due. I mean, there's so much good care given by family members, particularly in Huntington's disease, where the years of caregiving are longer than in Alzheimer's, for instance, or for other, or for Parkinson's. It's a longer time course, a more exhausting one, more behavioral problems, more motor problems. So then these other illnesses that dementing illnesses that require long-term care. It is truly when I looked for articles that tried to give me an idea of how long the are people or individuals with Huntington's in long-term care facilities prior to death, there's very, very little information, and what there is very old. And it said, and it gave me the 2 to 8 years range, but nothing very recent has been, there's nothing in the last several decades that give us an idea of what is the proportion of long-term care that is provided by families and friends versus unpaid family and friends versus paid caregivers. And there's got to be a lot of time, probably the majority of years, would be my guess, that families are providing care, except in those situations where individuals need to be institutionalized because of psychiatric reasons or because people become estranged from families and are homeless or live by themselves, then in family or informal caregivers just don't apply, and of course in that situation.
Right.
But there are a lot of patient years of care given.
Well,
I
put up your article up on the chat room so people could click on the article. It's a good short and sweet one. I did a little poll for us before the show on Facebook, and mm-hmm. I only had 10 participants, but it's kind of a good, I think, you know,
of course,
sampler of what we're dealing with. 40% were caregiving 1 to 5 years, 30% were caregiving 6 to 10 years, 20% 11 to 15 years. That's kind of high, 20%. And then our JHD 10% were caregiving for 6 to 10 years. It's kind of interesting,
right.
Isn't it?
Yes,
that's a long time.
Yes, it is. I'm not surprised, based on my. Of course, you're not querying those people who have severe psychiatric disturbance, probably.
Right.
So you have a biased population that you are putting the survey, who are answering the survey, probably. And of course, the people who are homeless are not going to be taken care of or live alone for whatever reason. It would be, if you could extend that and try to get a little more people signing in on that, that would be very useful, I think, to know, because it's not something that has really been studied. How long people are in are cared for by, caretakers provide care before late stage,
right?
Of course, when the it's partial care, it doesn't mean 24-hour supervision, but there's a lot of care that happens before people are put into a late stage category. So mm-hmm. we're even underestimating the number of patient years of care that are given to Huntington's individuals by families. So there's a lot of it. I think that's fair to say.
Right. One of the comments was very interesting. She said, on top of the personal stress, there's also the stress of maintaining one's home, replacing broken glass, punched doors, cleaning the furniture, not having friends over as often, which lends into losing many people. Many of these things, which is actually part of one's home community, go to pot, so to speak. Even the outside of the home becomes shabby. All this lends to the stress of a caregiver.
Of course. Well, I there was only one sentence I put in here about, quote, decreased care quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
They, I didn't list the 100 levels or more that defines that,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that increases over time as fatigue increases over time. So you hardly have enough energy to think about it anymore, of how low your quality of life can sometimes get. I made short shrift of that, but that doesn't mean that I believe it's unimportant or severe, mm-hmm. Or not severe by any means. There's so many levels. There were 100 could be listed.
Right.
A decreased health, decreased depression. Increased depression.
Right.
Illness, loss of friends, isolation. And even apathy. Caregivers develop apathy. Why care
mm-hmm.
anymore?
Mm-hmm.
There are no services out there that are helping me. So why care about it?
Yeah, that's sad.
Why try to find something? You're not going to find it anyway. There's a defeatist kind of. And the feeling of futility that has, that's not imaginary, about being able to access as many services that as you need.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And the paid services.
Right.
Who's going to pay for the services? Because the person caregiving can't afford them, right? Typically.
Well, there are a small fraction of individuals who do come from some wealth, and they are often the ones who can be taken care of at home because there's private financial funds to allow in-home caretakers for very long portions of the, you know, the 24-hour period. For those people who don't have that availability, as is the majority of our families, there are services through home health agencies that do provide some things on an intermittent scale, but are usually not helpful for long periods of time, for the, you know, the 24/7 that goes on in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And even if and in many places you may not live next to a center who has a team of people who know about Huntington's, so you can have, you know, lack of availability of home health services. You just can't access them, or they're not there, or they may not have enough education, have enough knowledge about Huntington's to be helpful even if they come into your home. So there are deficiencies all along. Now, this is not unique to the Huntington's community. This is present in many chronic diseases. There is not as much home health care available, particularly for mental illness and psychological behavioral things. There are lack of services.
Mm-hmm.
There's lack of services that come into the home. There's lack of subsidized housing availability for people who are on their own. So there are lack of services. There's no lack of services, but it's not it's not unique to Huntington's, but it's more severe in Huntington's families because the course of the disease is long, and it is impacted both by motor, cognitive, and behavioral problems. So it's harder than most chronic diseases.
Right. I have some comments here for you. Sharon says, a community mental health care program is helping me with my son at home after being hospitalized for a year, which is
great.
Good.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are examples of, there certainly are examples of very, in certain areas, of very good situations. At the end of the article, I mentioned one that is happening in the Netherlands, where they have a Huntington-specific clinic with, you know, a psychiatrist, a neurologist, an occupational therapist, and all of those goodies, all of those good people who work as a team, who see people in clinic, but they also go to their home as part of care, not just when they're asked to go, but it is part of care to see how people are in the home, to help with safety things, the occupational things at home, which is certainly different than it might appear in the clinic. For instance, one of my own patients, I remember I learned a lot about making a home visit. When he came to clinic, he had a lot of chorea.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was visited at home, he had very little, because he wasn't anxious at home. He was comfortable in his home setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if I had worked on treating his chorea that I saw just in the office, I would have way over-treated him.
Mm-hmm.
So how the person is in the home situation is important to see or get that information from the care partner.
Mm-hmm. I have one comment.
Mm-hmm.
And one comment that it's more along the lines of a caregiver tip, but she says, Sherry says, I would like to say how important it is to keep a caregiver's log and medication log, which yeah. will help us keep things in on track.
Right.
And yeah, we have another comment. She says, this is Judy, she says, this topic is not talked about enough. I wonder why. Try to whitewash the difficulty of HD, trying not to freak out families, not sure, but without the truth being shared, then we caregivers feel like it must just be me and they feel estranged. Ooh, that's a good point.
Right.
Then we have another one that says, let's see, there was another one. She says, yes, it's true, many years of caregiving for her, 12 years after diagnosis, but 5 years before diagnosis. So it was a long, remarkably rigorous and emotionally and physically taxing. She says, I thought I'd die before my husband. Oh, gosh.
Well, of course. I mean, that those are the stories. You know, there has been, there's nothing that makes caregiving easy. You know,
mm-hmm.
dream on, it's not going to be there. It's nothing makes it easy. It can be fulfilling, at least on some days, of course, when we care for those that we love. Those feelings are sometimes overwhelmed by fatigue and problems. I think one of the things I tried to do, you know, we can say how hard it is and, you know, what... etc. And of course that's real and those stories are important and need to be told and shared. But also sharing, as Sharon did, that, you know, teaching, sharing with other caregivers or teaching caregivers to problem solve. Now, keeping a log of behavior and medications is a way of problem solving. So
right.
You know, are problems occurring with that person at a particular time of the day? Then trying to troubleshoot what's happening at that particular time of the day, is a drug wearing off? Is the person hungry? You know, what's going on? So teaching caregivers, you know, teaching ourselves, teaching each other, having people who have experience, you know, medical care care providers,
mm-hmm.
the formal ones, formal and informal, you know, teaching
the paid and unpaid
problem solving skills. Just as Sharon mentioned, there are large numbers of those. They don't make the problem go away. They help deal with it a little more effectively, at least on some of the days.
Right.
So sharing and telling other people, you know, what works with a certain problem, how to go about problem solving is probably the most important thing, I believe. One of the other things that they found effective, of course, this was not in Huntington. I mentioned a study of, you know, what is it that seems to help caregivers of individuals with dementia mm-hmm. and in Canada. And this is a fairly recent study. And they found that if you involved patients in addition to caregivers in the discussion,
mm-hmm.
caregiver issues, then, mm-hmm. you know, that can help if you have the right person, you know, leading the conversation. If you have a person who can not rile people up or can keep things from getting riled is what I should
right.
say. And you can't always do that. But hearing the viewpoints of both person who is cared for and carer and having that conversation with someone else present is actually helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I know in my support groups, and I have the luxury of on some of the support group evenings having a wonderful social worker take caregivers, care mm-hmm. partners into another room while I stay with the with those who are affected by Huntington's or their care partners if they want to stay in that group, and we separate.
Mm-hmm.
But on other times, we are together.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're together, we can often get to the root of an issue.
Yes,
and
I agree.
Discuss
we
it.
Do that too.
Yeah. So I think that that's a good point. You know, sometimes you need to be by yourself and with people, you know, carers or patients, but having the discussion with both caregivers and with individuals with Huntington's is useful too.
Here's another comment that I completely understand. She says, there are some doctors who don't recognize the psychiatric problems as being part of HD, and it's hard to fight that battle, right? And then she says, one psychiatrist actually suggested family counseling for her and her son so that they could learn to get along. There's a lot of education that needs to happen, right, about...
Right, there is, you know, I have to chuckle, too. You know, part of the issue, part of a way of handling that is to, when you are in an area where you don't have access to someone who knows and pays attention to the behavioral and psychiatric situations with Huntington's, then taking some information with you. You know, I keep harping a little bit on algorithms.
Yes.
But short, page length sorts of things to describe the symptoms and to help them be aware that these are real parts of, real and important parts of Huntington's is terribly important. So sometimes you have to bring the mountain to Muhammad.
Right.
You have to bring the information to the doctor for them to become educated. This is, the lack of education is very severe.
Yeah, it is.
With our medical providers and with our home health workers, nurses, hospice workers, occupational therapists, physical therapists, you name it, it's a fairly rare disease and they are not trained. They are not given education as much as we would like about Huntington's. So sometimes we have to take and gently educate them.
You say gently.
The other,
sometimes we aren't
gently,
so gentle.
I should say tactfully.
Tactfully, that's the word.
Because a lot of doctors do not like to be told that they don't know something, so you don't say
that
it that
true.
Way.
Right. Oh, goodness. Yeah, we have to be very careful how we bring things about.
Well, doctors are sometimes hard to deal with, as you know. I'm certainly hard to deal with some days. So.
Not you at all.
Well, some days.
But good comments from everyone.
So, but
for
we have to be the advocate, and we have to not only educate ourselves, but be able to educate those that we need to get help from.
Now, I listened to a radio show a few days ago, and I didn't write the link down, but I'm going to research it. There was a woman who, her one of her best friends had gotten cancer, and she belonged to a group of women. I think they had a church group. And what they ended up doing was establishing, well, they have a nonprofit now, but they established this collective or co-op, I guess you would call it, of women who would go in, take turns, and help this person who was dying of cancer, basically. And it turned out to be quite a model. And I don't know if that would be something that we could, establish with Huntington's. I don't know.
Well, certainly church groups or community groups. I think, you know, our support groups do this to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I think many individuals, you know, once, you know, the caretaking has ended, or with that person's death, or with the individual coming to us with their death, there's a tendency for people to need a little respite.
Right.
And not go back to it right away. But there, mm-hmm. but there are certainly, I have within my support group, people who are doing just that,
mm-hmm.
that are helping with transportation, doing, you know, not a lot of care, but doing what they can within
yep.
their lives and their own. So there are a lot of good people organizing it as a group, organizing it within a group, and sharing responsibility is a wonderful model.
Mm-hmm. Here's another comment. This is Sharon again. And then hope the doctor will read it and learn from it. She's talking about providing education to the doctor. The doctor at the state mental hospital told me I needed to find a doctor whose philosophy about HD was the same as mine, that they viewed it as a medical illness.
Oh, boy, isn't that an issue. The psychiatrists, mental hospitals, institutions are, this is a common refrain that, you know, this is not, and with mental health providers, when you're trying to find housing for a Huntington's person, subsidized housing, as
mm-hmm.
I'm in the process of doing right now, for a person with Huntington's, well, they say, well, it's not a mental illness, so don't go through my agency.
Yeah.
So it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It is rife. That's part of, it's interesting that that is much more so in North America than it is in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that has to do, you know, with Huntington's the primary doctor for Huntington's, the specialist for Huntington's, is the neurologist. In Europe, it's often the psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And there is much more knowledge of an appreciation of the behavioral, the importance that they're there, the importance of behavioral symptoms as a component of Huntington's. It's
mm-hmm.
just, you know, our neurologists in this country do not learn about psychiatry. I'm going to say that again. Isn't it amazing? Our education
yeah.
system, medical education system for neurologists in this country does not include a lot of psychiatry. In
that's
Europe,
crazy.
That's not the case. That is not the case.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
brain diseases should be the province of both psychiatry and Europe gets this better than
yeah.
North America does.
Wow.
Okay, so
here's another good comment.
Sharon's right
says,
on. I'm not sure what to do about that besides
change
some people at the American Academy of Neurology.
Oh, there you go. Okay, here's another one. Oops, wait a minute, hold on. I just scrolled up. Mary says, with Paul, his doctor is her Facebook friend, and said that he's learned a lot about Paul just from her posts and photos. Hey, that's a novel concept, right?
Right.
No, yeah, Sharon wants to know, how do we get this changed?
I am not allowed to use Facebook.
Yeah. How do we get that changed, Sharon wants to know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think
Here's another one from Carla. How in the world could the medical professionals think this is not a mental illness? Should have spent some time with my son and me at three different psych units. Wow.
Well, doctors Aww. Sometimes are not the brightest bulbs.
Well,
forgiveness. Doctors out there.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
you know, it's not just that. You know, I'm giving doctors too hard of a time. Our education system of doctors.
Yeah, that's it. It's not the doctors; it's the education
mental
system.
Illness. You know, doctors, by and large, want to help people. Often, we don't know how. And how do we learn how? Well, we're taught first in, you know, we're taught in medical
really
school, and in our residency.
It comes from the education.
So it starts there.
Yeah.
And that's
where
the solution needs to begin.
I agree. Here's another comment from Judy. For my family, the behavioral problems were the only real problem. We didn't care about the movements or choking or falling. It was the behavior that caused the family angst or ER visits, police interactions, et cetera.
Sure. Behavioral manifestations of Huntington's that are not, you know, controlled are terribly, 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 I'll say it three times, hard on families. Many of the behavioral manifestations can be handled with drugs, not all, but many can. And keep trying. Many of the drugs will have side effects that may interfere with swallowing and cognition and other symptoms, other problems with Huntington's, but most, in many cases, not all, there can be management of behavioral symptoms. You can't make them go away, mm-hmm. or just make them less severe.
Carla says, behavior issues are messy and not a warm and comfy space. People don't like to talk about that, right?
That's right. They don't. It's uncomfortable. It is not a place we want to go.
Sharon wants to know, how do we get diagnostic criteria changed so that people can get diagnosed without chorea?
Well, it's an ongoing effort, you know, of education.
Right.
You know, motor symptoms are important. That's part of it. The behavioral symptoms are very, very important, too. It's not that one is more important than the other. Each of them cause, you know, serious and disabling parts of Huntington's. It's not that one's more important than the other. They have different manifestations, and they, you know, bother in different ways. So how do the education starts, you know, at the beginning of doctors, and if you're in the middle of this now, you say, well, that's going to help a lot, Yvonne. That's really going to help a lot for me to go and educate somebody.
Is that not helping me one bit now. Is there a mental impairment scale?
I'm sorry?
No, there's a chorea. Judy's saying that there's a chorea scale, but there's no scale for rigidity or dystonia. Is there a scale... a diagnostic scale for mental impairment?
There are cognitive levels of impairment, levels of cognitive impairment. There are also levels of severity for behavioral. You know, the UHDRS, you know, there are motor measures. There's the hyperkinetic or the chorea ones, and there's the hypokinetic ones that are related to rigidity, and there are measures of severity for that. There's measures of severity for really all of the symptoms of Huntington's. I mean, most of them, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Do
we've got lots of work to do, Dr. Goodman. We've got lots of education to happen. How do we get education in our medical schools?
Well, I think we need to work with the Huntington Study Group clinicians, the doctors who are, you know, leaders of our centers of excellence and tertiary centers for Huntington's. Need to work within their medical schools to help teach more than the biology of Huntington's.
Is that happening now? Do you think they're starting to do that more?
I can only speak from the ones that I know. In general, there is a day or there's a day or two talk about Huntington's in medical school. And and a lot of that's on the interesting biology, because a lot is known about the biology of Huntington's. And there tends to be more of a focus on that in medical schools than on symptoms. You know, the genetics of it are taught very well. The molecular biology, I think, is taught. I think the clinical, various clinical presentations of Huntington's are probably not taught as well, and care of Huntington's for sure is not taught very well. And unless you are a resident who rotates through a Huntington's clinic, then you will not see much Huntington's. Because, you know, Huntington's is mostly an outpatient illness. You don't get it by, you know, working as a resident in the hospital. You rarely see it.
Right.
And that's
rare to
find.
A
lot of the learning of for medical students and for interns and residents occurs. You know, and our centers of excellence, our doctors don't have control over what's taught in medical school. Can they help influence it? I think many of them try.
What if we did CMEs? Would that help? Offering credits for education?
One of the things the Huntington Study Group is doing is each year when they have their annual meeting, they do invite community physicians in and teach them about Huntington's for a day.
Well, we do that too, but once a year is not enough. We need to do it every day.
We can only do what we can do. And we would like to have it be much more taught, and so would, families of people with cystic fibrosis or breast cancer or all of the many other medical things that doctors need to learn to give all people best care. You know, there are no such docs who know it all. We may act like it someday.
Here's a question from Sharon. She wants to know who determines the diagnostic criteria for HD? Where does that standard come from?
The diagnostic standard, clinical diagnostic standard, was developed by the Huntington Study Group way back when a certain amount of chorea was what was diagnostic.
Mm-hmm.
However, and that has kind of stayed for a whole bunch of different reasons, whether they're good reasons or not, you know, one can argue that. But there's certainly recognition that there are cognitive, you know, Dr. Paulson and her decade-long study of Huntington's before motor diagnosis has clearly shown that there are variable, you know, varies from individual to individual. There are cognitive losses. Some can be profound before motor onset, although most are not. There are also a lot of behavioral things that happen prior to motor onset, and they can be quite severe and disabling. So there's recognition of that. By the specialists. Is there recognition of that by community physicians? No. Most of us community physicians, or many of us like me, are old. And that certainly wasn't the diagnostic criteria when I was taught about Huntington, that if there were other things happened prior. I think that, you know, we're trying very hard. I think, you know, the Huntington's study group and the equivalent group in Europe are trying very hard to get some standards of care that generalists can use. I have the privilege of working with a bunch of experts that will hopefully come out with some not just, pharmacologic guidelines for taking care of a symptom, but recognizing it in mm-hmm. Huntington's. Those will hopefully be out in less than a year for use by Huntington's families. It's a long process.
And will that cover the psychiatric too, or will that cover the
No. It will cover certain symptom presentations and definitions like anxiety, like agitation, sleep disorders, apathy, psychosis, aggression, and how it manifests in Huntington's. So I think work is ongoing, but it doesn't change. It changes slowly.
Yeah. One comment is 2 out of 3 people in her family did not have chorea. Many of the ones that are in this group today are not talking about chorea. They're talking about the psychiatric symptoms. And Judy wants to know if we can ask HSG to do a scale for that, a diagnostic scale.
Scale for what?
For the psychiatric.
Well, there are part of the UHDRS does query about and measure.
Oh no, she says
frequency.
Rigidity dystonia scale. I'm sorry, strike that. What I just said. She said, let's see if we can get the HSG to recognize.
They actually are measured items in the UHDRS. That doesn't mean that non-research clinicians know how to do it. It is recognized as that there are a large number of motor symptoms in Huntington's that are not chorea, and they are part of the UHDRS,
mm-hmm.
and they are measured. The severity is measured.
It is in rigidity and dystonia.
Right.
Huh. Interesting.
Those are
okay.
part of the UHDRS. Do they get as much weight, in the total motor score? They do not. So your point is well taken. Yes, it's measured, but they don't in the total, I think it's 24 total counts in the motor score. Chorea is very heavy weighted, more so than dystonia and rigidity. So your point is well taken. There's too much emphasis placed on chorea. Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think a lot of people are agreeing that is so.
Everybody's thanking you in the group. They're all saying thank you, Dr. Goodman. We have another comment. Let me find it. Sherry says, can you explain how important it is if you're feeling burnout as a caregiver to get someone to give you help? Church, community, what does she say? Mental.
Boy, it's so important. But in my experience, there have been very few care partners who are burned out who actually take that advice.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because, and I have had, I think, one of the most amazing carers of one of my Huntington's patients just wouldn't let anybody else do it because no one could do it as good as she could. And she was right. No one could do it as good as she could. So getting her to access some help was actually turned out to be impossible. She also, though, had self-coping mechanisms. She had studied architectural and design things.
Mm-hmm.
So what she did in her years of caretaking is she would take on one room at a time.
Oh, I think you told me about this person before. Where she would decorate?
And would decorate it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, would, you know, sand
therapy.
This floor, you know, strip this wallpaper.
Oh, my goodness.
Over the years, room by room, you know, it brought her pleasure.
Right.
It gave her something she had control over. She could start it and stop it when she wanted. It was always something that she did for herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each person has a different skill set. You know, mm-hmm. She didn't do meditation or things like that. She stripped wallpaper. And she did get people to come in and help her, too. So that was what was her therapy. Well,
mm-hmm.
She also came to my support group. And, you know, I made house calls, so there were other things going on, too.
Well, you came to California.
You know, our system, our, you know, it's. I have the luxury of that because I'm mostly retired from my internal medicine practice. I am retired from that. I would not be able to do that, you know, in my earlier years of doing medicine because the systems don't allow it.
Mm-hmm.
Where was I going with that? In other countries where medical care is provided in different ways, you know, these things are handled sometimes better. In Germany, for instance, you pay into a fund that provides long-term care.
Wow.
Or long-term care assistance. And a person can transition from one level of care to another without bankrupting the family because they paid for it as they've gone along. The government, that's a part of the government plan.
Yeah, I think what Sherry said was so key about it might not be the fact that you want somebody to come in and care for the person that has Huntington's, but you may need maybe somebody to bring you a meal or somebody to come vacuum your rug or something, you know, vacuum your carpet or come and weed your yard or something, just somebody
of
to
course.
Come and help do some house chores or yard chores that, you know, you're so exhausted from caregiving being up all night or 24/7.
Right.
You
so
just don't have
systems
the
systems can we put in place? Do we have in place, you know, other than churches
mm-hmm.
or disease communities, family communities, support groups, of course, those things are super helpful, but how do we get those services to the people who need them?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
What kinds of organizations, who can you mobilize? I think often in rural church communities, they do this very well.
Mm-hmm.
In our urban areas, we do it less well. Unless you have an exception, and there are some exceptional, you know, community and church groups. But I don't believe that there are, you know, organizational.
Maybe we just
home
need
health
to start something like that. Carla says, in the States, there's no assistance unless you want to place your loved one. Oops, come back. In a nursing home, and she says, we are exhausted physically, mentally, and financially. Mm. Yep.
That is a common, unfortunate experience of families. Even if, when you can have made a decision for a nursing home, you can't find one that knows about Huntington's. You can't find one that will help.
Yeah.
In fact, take an individual to Huntington sometimes. It's just, you know, the list of lack of care goes on. And there's one thing that could be, you know, one thing that we could be a suggestion I have for our advocacy organizations is to advocate for increased reimbursement scales for people with Huntington's in nursing mm-hmm. homes. Because right now, nursing homes do not get an increased monthly rate for taking care of someone with Huntington's versus someone
no.
with Alzheimer's, even though the care needs are much greater. So
mm-hmm.
Huntington's
That's
individuals
true.
Are often discriminated against based on that financial barrier. Now, that is
mm-hmm.
something that could potentially be changed with, you know, advocacy and advocating it at governmental levels.
Right. Sherry says she had long-term care, but it was taken away, and then they wouldn't even let her pay for it. So she says her wish is for every family to get this insurance before they're diagnosed, long-term care. She said she had long-term care, but it was taken away. And she said community health was coming in, so also Dr. Goodman, but stopped because of grants.
Yeah.
So the programs
you know,
that are...
care. Right, long-term care insurance used to be, you know, a decade ago, used to be easier to get. They now ask about family history, often long-term care. And if there is a family history,
mm-hmm.
Then you will not be allowed without, you know, paying a lot more for it to have long-term
mm-hmm.
care insurance. And if you, you know, if you develop Huntington's and you call this into and you then ask for the, you know, the long-term care insurance to come through, if they can show that you knew that there was a family history, it can be taken away from you.
Right.
It didn't used to be that way.
Yeah.
It is presently, so it's harder to get.
Yeah. It's sad.
And Jeannie doesn't help with that. Well, I think
no.
we've talked a long time about this. Because there's no, there, you know, it's we could go on and on for hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more help is needed really at all levels.
Right.
Our caregiver support groups can be very helpful. Our online ones, our support, I personally think that in person is better, but not everyone has that option. In fact, most people probably don't have that option. Talking about it, sharing experiences, sharing things that worked, problem solving, helping each other out, and as much as possible, drawing in other families, saying, I need some help, and if you can't
right.
help with him, you can help with this. If you can't
mm-hmm.
help with my person, you can help with this other thing. Will
right.
you do that? Can you do that? I need it.
I need
it's hard
help
to ask
now.
For help. Isn't it so
yeah.
hard to ask for help?
It is.
We want to be
but...
independent. We want to do it all ourselves. Nobody can do it as well as we can. There's a component of that. And then there's on the other side, there are, you know, situations where, you know, you don't have someone to turn to.
Right.
They're all, hopefully there is something that can be done. You know, sometimes we give up and say, well, there is just nothing out there. And we just have to admit that there's nothing out there and plug along. And sometimes
right.
we do that. But we need to sleep on it and get up the next day and try again.
And you never know. There may be a volunteer corps or, you know, something through other means that you just got to keep looking, you know. And, well, my philosophy
sometimes
is...
Sometimes it won't be there.
If it's not there, then create it. But not
well,
everybody
you know,
can do that.
If you have any energy left.
Right, right. Dr. Goodman, thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Everybody in the chat room is very, very grateful that you have brought this information to us, and had a really good show. A couple announcements, if you guys can hang for a couple more minutes. We have our HD Awareness Day coming up on May 16 in Lompoc, California. If you are in Lompoc area or Santa Maria area, give me a call at 805-441-5618. It's going to be a fun day, barbecue, games and activities for the kids, a band. The mayor will be out to proclaim HD Awareness Day. It'll be a fun time. And we're trying to open a resource center and affordability shop in Lompoc area on the Central Coast. There is absolutely nothing there right now for Huntington's, and it's desperately needed in the Central Coast area. We have, you know, we don't have any centers of excellence here, or, you know, even neurologists that are willing to work with Huntington's at this point. So we're trying to kind of fill in the gap. And then June 13, we have our very first kids, JHD Kids Walk in Sacramento at McKinley Park. And that is going to be epic. We have so much support, and we're looking for donations to support the JHD Research Initiative at the University of California, Davis. They have started a JHD Research Initiative, which we are all for, and we're trying to raise money for that. And then in August 22nd, our annual conference will take place in Riverside at the Mission Inn in Riverside. All are welcome to join us there. And then November 7, we have a 5K run. It's in memory of a fellow. His name is Nick, and we're going to be doing Nick's run for HD in San Diego. So those are coming up, and I think next show will be with Cynthia Trousseau, Toussaint, and she is the founder of an organization called For Grace. She's an amazing woman, and she's started her foundation, written a book. She's talking, you know, giving talks all over the country now about dealing with pain, and she was diagnosed with regional pain syndrome, and she's going to be on the show, I think, on the 19th. Dr. Goodman, thank you again for bringing this information to us. It looks to me like our caregivers are really wanting to get more information about how to get help for the lives that we live as caregivers. So let's keep working on that. And don't forget to tell all your colleagues, families, and family members and friends about Help for HD, and tune into the website, helpforhd.org. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And Dr. Goodman, have a great week, month, and we'll talk to you very, very soon. And thank you, everyone in the chat room, for tuning in. Everyone for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.